Right now we have a curfew in Nochistlán, in the place. We are, this moment, we don't have any specific activity, but we are waiting for the next scenes of the battle. The battle has just started. We are not at the battle.
We're going to continue this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Gustavo Esteva, founder of the University of the Land in Oaxaca, author of many books, speaking to us from Oaxaca. This is Democracy Now! Special thanks to our team, to Mike Burke, to Andres Contreras. I'm Amy Goodman. We have two job openings. Check our website. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Debtors Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st at 4 p.m. under the bridge at Cathedral Park in Portland. Strike Debt is a nationwide movement of debt resistors fighting for economic justice and democratic freedom. This event also features a Strike Debt Portland potluck. Again, that's the Debtors Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st, 4 to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Stay up late with Lanita Duke and Grassroots News on Wednesday, June 22nd from 10 p.m. until midnight, as we celebrate the music of Roberta Flack, as well as agitating for social change. Remember, stay up late with me, Wednesday, June 22nd, 10 p.m. until midnight on KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown calls for lead and radon testing in Portland schools.
A Nike-sponsored coach is at the center of an international doping scandal.
And live in Studio 2, we speak with Reverend John Fife about an upcoming vigil for immigrants and refugees. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 21st, 2016. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Get ready to do some detouring if Southwest Broadway is part of your daily commute. Southwest Broadway Drive is scheduled to close between Southwest Grant Street and Southwest Vista Avenue starting today. The mile of road will be closed throughout the rest of June and all of July, with plans to reopen this August. The road will be closed to replace a retaining wall as well as a water line that runs through the part of Southwest Broadway Drive. Guardrail improvements will also be made as a part of this project. While the road will be closed to vehicle traffic, bicycle and pedestrian access will continue to remain open. For more information on alternative routes, check out PBOT's website at www.portlandoregon.gov/transportation.
High lead levels have been found in water at some Portland parks. According to a study released by the Portland Parks and Recreation Department, 17 fixtures around the city tested high for lead. The city says that those fixtures will be replaced. Four locations were found to have the elevated levels coming from the Portland Children's Museum, the Mount Tabor Annex, and the Fulton Community Center, and the Multnomah Arts Center.
Governor Kate Brown has announced that Oregon State Board of Education is considering adopting a new rule that would require yearly lead and radon testing in schools. If the board decides to adopt the ruling, Oregon school districts would also be required to submit a plan in the fall for adopting recommendations on clean air, clean water, and healthy environments. This push is in response to high lead levels recently found in Portland public schools. More on the specifics of the drafted ruling will be revealed this Thursday at the next Board of Education meeting. A public hearing will be held at 10 a.m. on August 2nd in room 251 AB in the Public Service Building in Salem.
An Oregon environmental group, Cascadia Wildlands, has filed a complaint against three state lawmakers today for trying to pass a bill that would stop gray wolves from being listed as an endangered species. Gray wolves received Endangered Species Act protection in 1974. They were reclassed from endangered to threatened 30 years later. In 2011, Congress voted to remove the gray wolf from federal endangered species lists. The delisting in most of the Northwest was attached to a budget deal between the White House and Congress. Oregon's Fish and Wildlife Commission removed the gray wolf from the endangered species list last year. Cascadia Wildlands has called the decision premature and scientifically flawed in its report to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Three lawmakers listed in the complaint are Oregon State Representatives Sal Esquivel, Greg Barreto, and Brad Witt.
Today, conservation groups submitted petitions to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Board of Forestry to uplist the marbled murrelet. The groups involved in this signing the petition include Cascadia Wildlands, Oregon Wild Coast Range Forest Watch, the Center for Biological Diversity, the Audubon Society of Portland, and the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. The groups hope to gain endangered status for the seabird, which has been listed as threatened for close to 30 years under the state of Oregon. The birds nest exclusively in old-growth forests, making habitat conservation crucial to the protection of their species. However, their status as a threatened species has meant little as the murrelet's nesting habitats continue to be clear-cut. The shift from threatened to endangered would highlight the needs of the species. On the petition, the groups also urged the state of Oregon to create a plan and take action to protect many of the old-growth forests that the murrelets nest in. KABU reporter Abigail Sloan spoke with Steve Pettery at Oregon Wild.
They're really one of the species that's sort of a canary in the coal mine for the health of our forests. Since they need old growth and they live in the coast, they have been hit very hard in the past 50 years and really especially hard in the past 20 by aggressive clear cutting of those coastal forests. You have seen what industrial forestry in Oregon looks like these days, and it looks like clear cuts on steep slopes and conversion of native forests where you would have trees that were 200, 300 years old into these industrial tree plantations where you have trees that are 25, 30, 40 years old and then they're clear cut again. And, you know, under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, there is no protection for old growth forest. You can log a 200, 300-year-old tree just fine on state or private lands in Oregon. What we're asking the state to do here at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Department of Forestry is to basically do their jobs. They need to develop a recovery plan for these species, and they need to create a rule book for how forests are managed to not further harm them. And that's, you know, sort of what we'd like to see, landowners managing more for environmental considerations. You know, we're not asking for an end to timber harvesting. We're asking people to manage more responsibly. And we're asking state land managers to set aside some areas that are managed for conservation and for fish and wildlife. And, you know, the problem with that is they have drug their feet and look the other way. And over the last 30 years, the plight of these birds has gotten worse. And we feel now that they deserve endangered protection, not just threatened. If they choose to move quickly, you know, we could see things develop in the next year. If they choose to drag their feet, it could take a number of years before we see any improvement on the ground for murrelets, and, you know, there may be a longer fight ahead. So, you know, we're under no illusions that this is going to be an easy or fast process here in Oregon. The big change, I think, that the murrelet could drive is more of a conversation about how Oregonians want these resources managed. I think, you know, maybe 30, 40 years ago, the average Oregonian was okay with clear-cutting old-growth forests, but that certainly isn't the case today. And I think our land management agencies need to catch up with the times.
That was Steve Pedry from Oregon Wild speaking with KABU reporter Abigail Sloan.
The General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA is meeting this week in Portland, and tonight they are holding a vigil calling for a compassionate response to the Central American refugee crisis. Here to speak with us about this is Reverend John Fife. He is a pastor emeritus at Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. He is a founder of the Sanctuary Movement and a co-founder of the immigrant rights group No More Deaths. Reverend Fife, thank you so much for being here with us in Studio 2.
Nice to be with you. I'm a big fan of community radio. Thank you.
So first off, there's a vigil happening right now as we speak, right, if I understand correctly. Where is it and what's going on?
It's at the statue in front of the Oregon Convention Center where the assembly is meeting all this week. And as people go in and out, especially as meetings end, almost everyone goes to dinner. And so the vigil's being held in a strategic place so that we might get the attention of all the commissioners.
And what is why has the vigil been called?
Vigil's been called because there's a tragedy unfolding in the United States, and particularly in the Southwest of the United States. due to an influx of refugees from the gang violence and the inability of the governments of El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala to protect the civilian population. And so people are fleeing extortion and murder. Honduras has the highest murder rate in the world. And El Salvador is pressing them to exceed even their murder rate. And the gang violence and the extortion and the rape and the murder is just unprecedented. And so people flee. The United Nations High Commission on Refugees has said to the United States, the studies that they've done are that the vast majority of these people should be considered refugees, should be given protected status. And the United States, in an election year, fearing the political implications of a influx of refugees on our southern border, has decided to raid the homes of Central American refugees, to deport them publicly. This is mothers and children, primarily. And to use that as a deterrent against other people trying to flee for their lives. Now, that's a violation of United States law. It's a violation of international law and human rights. And we're trying to call as much attention to that human tragedy and government violations of law and human rights as we can.
In your eyes, why do you think it is that we don't refer to people coming into our country from Mexico and Central America as refugees?
Well, because that would mean that we would be required by our law to protect them, to grant them protected status, and to give them all of the rights that refugees are due under United States law. And as you understand the politics of this moment in an election year, that's very dangerous politically, because there's a major portion of the political body in this election year that's using racism and xenophobia and anti-immigrant rhetoric to gain a lot of traction within the electorate. And fear is a very powerful tool that those politicians are using. So everyone is very wary in this political year.
I don't want to get too much into semantics, but does this crisis that we're facing in our country seem that different definitionally from what we're seeing in the Mediterranean and in Greece and Macedonia? Does it seem like there's a significant distinction between those people that are coming from the Middle East and other parts, East and North Africa, and what we're seeing coming up from countries south of us?
There are distinctions. People fleeing toward the European Union from Syria and the Middle East are fleeing a war. They're fleeing out of a war zone and the bombings and all of the killings and they go with a war zone for their lives. People fleeing Central America are fleeing for their lives as well, but the circumstances are different. They're fleeing gang violence, cartel violence, and the threats to their life and the security of their person is exactly equal, but the circumstances that drive them out are different. That's all.
Can you tell us a little bit about the sanctuary movement and the story of how it was created in the 1980s?
Yeah, the crisis on the border then was different than the one now. But in the 1980s, people fleeing the death squads and the torture chambers and the massacres of hundreds of villages in El Salvador and Guatemala were arriving at our border. And again, the United States was not recognizing them as refugees. They were putting them in detention centers and deporting them as efficiently as possible back to the guys who tried to kill them in the first place or had already killed members of their family. So the question for us on the border was, what must we do? And a colleague of mine came to me and said, I don't think we have any choice except to start smuggling refugees safely across the border so they're not captured and deported. And I said, basically, how do you figure that? And his response was compelling. He said, we've had a similar situation in this country during the abolition movement when slaves were fleeing slave masters and crossing state lines and being apprehended by sheriffs and police and shipped back to the tender mercies of slavery. And he said, some people got it right. He said, they helped slaves cross the border safely, and they formed an underground railroad to move them to safer and safer places. And he said, I don't think we should be any different on our border in our time. And so a group of us started smuggling refugees across the border. And it took Border Patrol Intelligence Unit maybe 9 or 10 months to figure out what we were doing. We weren't that good at what we were doing. And so, they sent us a message that basically said, we think we know what you're up to. Stop it or we'll indict you. And so the question that then was, well, what do we do now? And the only thing we could think of was to go public with the plight of the refugees and what we were doing to protect them. And the question was, well, how do you do that? And what we did was reach back for the ancient tradition of sanctuary. And the church and places of worship as places of sanctuary, safe for people who are fleeing for their lives. And so we declared the church I served as a pastor a public sanctuary for Central American refugees and received a mother, father, and a couple kids into the sanctuary of the church. And a movement started. Other churches and synagogues understood the ethical demand to protect refugees and their lives. And so churches and synagogues all over the country, hundreds of them, began to declare sanctuary. 17 cities declared themselves cities of sanctuary, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and other medium-sized cities. And then colleges and universities got the idea and by vote of the student body and faculty declared the campus a sanctuary and protected refugees. And even the state of New Mexico declared itself a sanctuary. So we had a major movement on our hands.
Do you happen to know if Oregon declared itself a sanctuary?
No, New Mexico was the only one, but we'll work on it in this time.
Yeah. So that was nearly 30 years ago, perhaps a little bit more. How has that type of activism changed with the issues since its inception?
Well, only the cause, the context of people fleeing for their lives now has changed. And so refugees are now coming from Central America. They're not fleeing death squads run by the army and the oligarchs there. They're fleeing gang violence and the cartels and all of the murder and extortion that goes with that. So only the source of their flight has changed. But the problem is still the same in the United States, and that is the government refuses to obey our own laws and to protect refugees with political asylum here in this country.
So talk a little bit about the No More Deaths organization. What is it that you do?
Well, we started it in the year 2000. And we had to because the United States had initiated a border enforcement strategy that they'd never tried before. For the first time in the history of the United States declared, we're going to secure our border. And the way they were going to do it was to build walls through the urban areas of the border and across the valleys that was easy to build walls across, and to quadruple the number of Border Patrol agents and technology, and militarize the border, and to funnel the migration of workers, migrant workers, into the deadliest areas of the border. Now, here's the punchline. They said, then when it becomes obvious that people are dying trying to cross the border, we will use those deaths as a deterrent to other people trying to cross, and that's the way we'll secure the border. Well, whatever bright mind in a suit in Washington came up with that strategy obviously never understood the desperation of poverty. Would fathers and mothers risk their very lives in the desert in order to feed their children? And the answer is yes, by the thousands. And the tragedy is that this failed, tragically failed border enforcement strategy has directly resulted in the deaths of over 7,000 of the poorest of the poor in this region. And so seeing the first bodies be found in the desert south of Tucson, we pulled together folks who were involved in the sanctuary movement in the 1980s and basically started to go out to the desert, put water out there, save as many lives as we can. No more deaths, establishes camps with volunteers living in the camps, hiking the migrant trails, dropping water and food and blankets in the wintertime on those migrant trails. And we've formed a emergency medical clinic there in the desert that we can provide emergency medical care for migrants who are in very bad shape. We've been able to save a lot of lives, but this tragically failed border enforcement strategy still goes on.
What else can we be doing in the United States about immigration to mitigate what's going on, what you're describing?
It would be really great if we did immigration reform, wouldn't it?
Sure would be.
Everybody on both sides of the political spectrum acknowledge that the immigration policy and the immigration system of the United States is broken. It doesn't work. It has not worked for decades, and that we need to pass legislation that will fix a tragically broken system. But as you know, despite all of the efforts and efforts by leadership of both parties, the racist and xenophobic sector of the Congress has been able to block all attempts to legislate immigration reform. It would be wonderful if we could solve a lot of problems and save a lot of lives, thousands of them, if we could just get reasonable legislation passed by this Congress. But that's not going to happen because it's clear that there is a significant portion of our population in the United States, and there always has been if you read the history of immigration in the United States. There's a significant portion of the population, it's a minority, but it's a significant minority, that is xenophobic, that is racist, that is anti-immigrant, is quite willing to block any legislation that would reform the immigration system.
So I have a pretty enormous question, and we don't have very much time, but what would immigration reform look like in brief to you?
Very briefly, we have not had a way for workers who our economy has needed to sustain our economic life. We've not had a way since 1964 for them to cross with a document, with a temporary visa. We need to give those 11 million people who have done that and have been working in our communities a pathway to citizenship. Secondly, we need to provide for a guest worker program so no one else has to cross without documents in order to work in this country when we need their labor. And thirdly, we need to look carefully at what economic policies are doing to drive people from their homes in Mexico and Central America to the United States in order to feed their children. And trade agreements like the North American Free Trade Agreement and others, the Central American Trade Agreement, have literally driven millions of small and subsistence farmers off the land in Mexico and Central America, and they have nowhere to go to find employment except to cross the border. So we've got to stop that sort of nonsense.
So Reverend John Fife, we're just about out of time, but I do want to ask, how can KBOO listeners support your work and also the Presbyterian Vigil that's supporting Central American refugees tonight?
Well, the vigil's going on right now, so you'll be a little late if you try to get there to support it in person.
And where again is it happening?
In front of the Oregon Convention Center.
Okay.
But folks in Oregon have organized and are organizing to protect Central American refugees. They're organizing to protect migrant mothers and fathers from deportation. They're organizing against the ICE detention centers in Tacoma and other places. There are lots of great organizing efforts in Oregon that you can join, that you can find out about. Please do. It's an important work.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Reverend Fife. It's been wonderful having you on.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
That was Reverend John Fife of Tucson, Arizona. He is in town with the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA. You can find out more about No More Deaths at www.nomoredeaths.org.
A bipartisan group of senators put forth another gun control proposal Tuesday, a day after the United States Senate rejected four similar measures. Monday's four were destined to fail, but put lawmakers on record in an election year. The Senate's Republican leadership only allowed the votes after last week's 15-hour filibuster demanding lawmakers take action on guns. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
Just one day after the U.S. Senate rejected four gun control measures, largely along party lines, Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins unveiled what she calls a bipartisan compromise, the Terrorist Firearms Prevention Act of 2016. The proposal would prohibit gun sales to anyone on the FBI's no-fly or selectee lists. The latter identifies travelers who are subjected to extra security screenings. The measure includes an appeal process for people to contest their inclusion on the lists and a so-called look-back to notify the FBI when anyone who had been on one of those lists in the 5 years prior purchases a gun. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, a self-admitted AR-15 owner, was among the bipartisan phalanx of lawmakers at a Tuesday press conference announcing the proposed legislation.
To my friends at the NRA, I understand your concern about denying somebody the right to buy a gun that's a constitutional right. But every right, whether speech or buying a weapon or any other constitutional right, has boundaries on it.
The proposal follows the Senate's refusal to advance gun control legislation in the wake of the massacre of 49 people at an Orlando LGBT nightclub.
What am I going to tell 49 grieving families? What am I going to tell the families of those that are still in the hospital fighting for their lives?
A dejected Florida Senator, Democrat Bill Nelson, spoke to the media immediately after Monday's votes.
What am I going to tell the trauma surgeon whose blood-stained shoes have been shown in a picture on so many news programs, and who said he didn't know in the midst of the screams and the cries, if they were black or white or gay or straight, as they brought in over 40 all at one time into that trauma operating room? What am I going to tell the community of Orlando that is trying to come together in the healing? Sadly, what I'm going to have to tell them is the NRA won again.
The four proposals were put forth as amendments to a Justice Department spending bill that was currently on the floor, two by Democrats, two by Republicans, all equally untenable to the other side. The Democrats' proposals would have expanded background checks to gun shows and internet sales and banned all gun sales to people on the so-called terror watch list, a much broader list than the selectee and no-fly lists in Senator Collins' bill. The measure also included a mechanism to challenge one's inclusion on those lists and was put forth by California Democrat Dianne Feinstein. Again, the senator most recently proffered an almost identical measure last December following the mass shooting in San Bernardino.
The legislation that was defeated today included Second Amendment protections and the ability to appeal a denied gun administratively and in a court of law. It protected the ability of law enforcement to investigate potential crimes of terrorism. And most importantly, it would keep deadly firearms out of the hands of known and suspected terrorists.
But opponents say the dragnet around suspected terrorists is too broad and that innocent Americans might be barred from purchasing guns. Senate lawmakers also blocked the Republican proposals. One called for additional funds to enhance existing background checks, but not expand them to close the gun show loophole. The second would attach a 3-day waiting period for anyone suspected of involvement in terrorism, a window the Department of Justice says is insufficient. Senator Christopher Murphy, the Connecticut Democrat who led last week's 15-hour filibuster that forced the GOP to even schedule the Monday votes, says he wasn't at all surprised at the outcome, despite a disconnect with the vast majority of Americans.
We learned in the months after Sandy Hook that the NRA has a vice-like grip on this place, even when 90% of the American public wants change. New poll out today. 90% of Americans believe in expanded background checks. 87% of Americans think that terrorists shouldn't be able to buy guns. 87% of Americans, 90% of Republicans in that poll think that terrorists should not be able to buy guns.
A statement on the NRA website expresses support for the GOP-backed proposals, echoing the common sense adjective for the bills that the Department of Justice says are inadequate. Yet even while viewing the statement, a pop-up on the powerful gun lobby's website asks visitors to urge their lawmakers to block any and all gun control legislation. After the deeply political votes cast Monday night, Florida Senator Nelson joined the bipartisan group Tuesday. And according to Senator Collins, GOP Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has agreed to bring her bill to the floor for a vote as early as this week. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
You're listening to the Cable Evening News. Stay tuned for News in Depth at 5:45, followed by Cutie Pock Talk at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy with highs in the upper 70s and lows in the 50s here in Portland. East of the Cascades and Hood River, there'll be mostly sunny skies with highs in the upper 70s. Today in history, in 1942, a Japanese submarine surfaced near the Columbia River in Oregon, firing over a dozen shells at Fort Stevens. The quote of the day is from William H. Fulbright, who said, "In the long course of history, having people who understand your thought is much greater security than another submarine."
A prominent track coach was arrested in Spain in one of the biggest drug doping stories in sporting history. The coach has many connections with the Nike Corporation's top track athletes. Nike is one of Oregon's largest employers and has helped Oregon become the dominant capital of U.S. professional track. We spoke with KABU reporter Emery Mort for more on this story.
So Emery, why don't you tell us about what's going on in the world of distance running?
Well, perhaps the biggest doping scandal in distance running history is unfolding right now. In Spain, last night, after 4 weeks of around-the-clock surveillance, a group of authorities, anti-doping and police authorities from Spain, rushed in, searched some rooms, arrested a very prominent coach. And so the world of distance running and track and field is very shaken up right now.
So why did he get arrested?
He got arrested because when they went in his room, they found a bunch of EPO and steroids and syringes filled with drugs that are known to be very performance enhancing and very illegal.
And so how is he connected to Nike?
He coaches a lot of Nike athletes. I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows if he has an exact financial connection with Nike, but what happens is a lot of distance running athletes are sponsored by a company, and that's like a lot of their main professional payout. That's how they pay their bills. And so some of the world's top athletes sponsored by Nike are training with this coach, Jama Aden.
So for like our listeners who are wondering, well, what does this have to do with Oregon? For people who aren't actually that aware, as I am just finding out today, what does Oregon have to do with the world of like track and field?
Oregon is a major city in world track and field, and Oregon is pushing to become an even bigger force in international track and field. So residents of Oregon might notice that there are billboards up around the city of track athletes or celebrating events that are coming to Portland, such as the recent World Indoor Track and Field Championships. And in a couple summers, the World Outdoor Track and Field Championships is going to be held in the U.S. for the first time in Eugene. And so Nike's headquarters being in Beaverton, Nike has a huge influence on U.S. track and field and the University of Oregon. And so there's a huge connection just within this small corridor right here in the northwest corner of Oregon of influence in U.S. distance running and track and field, and also increasingly international track and field and all the politics that come with that.
So in addition to Nike sponsoring this coach, they're also sponsoring coaches locally here in Oregon, correct?
That's right. So there are multiple training groups here. Two of the prominent ones are the Nike Oregon Project, which is headed by Alberto Salazar. And then there's the Bowerman Track Club, which is headed by John Schumacher. And both of these groups train here in Portland and Beaverton. And for example, Nike Oregon Project, Mo Farah, who is an extremely prominent runner. He's the best distance runner on the planet right now. He's a he has a UK passport. He competes for the UK. But he's quite often training here in Portland. He's a member of the Nike Oregon Project. And he's going to come under some fire. He's already releasing some statements through his communications agency because he has at least some connection with this coach. And this is problematic when a coach that you have connections with gets arrested in such a massive doping scandal way. He's not been convicted yet, and there's not necessarily any proof that Mo Farah has in any way done anything wrong. There's no proof of that, but that connection is there.
So getting back to the arrest that happened, who was involved in that? Was it just the coach, or were there other athletes involved?
Some reports are saying that up to 30 athletes were not just involved, but were actually tested on the spot by the searching parties. And these athletes are not just any athletes. These athletes include some of the best athletes in the history of the sport of track and field. Three Dibaba sisters from Ethiopia were there, including Genzebe Dibaba, who currently holds the world record in the metric mile. And, you know, these athletes are gearing up for Olympic glory in a couple months. They're there training with their coach. So Genzebe Dibaba, athletes from all over the world. This coach was training.
Well, so it just sounds like this isn't a little scandal. This has the potential to just blow up into an absolutely huge worldwide doping scandal, which we've been seeing, you know, over the last few years in competitive sports. And the question is, what is this going to mean for the Olympic Games coming up?
Well, that's a good question. It's going to be on a lot of people's minds. For Aden himself, it could mean prison time. Spanish law says that those who administer doping could serve prison sentences. So if he's convicted of administering doping, he could go to prison for up to 2 years. He could be banned from the sport for likely something like 4 years. And even if athletes like Genzebe Dibaba don't test positive, if they do test positive, they're going to be suspended for at least 2 years. But if they don't, they could still be suspended for like connection with a coach who's obviously doping. So part of the problem is it's very difficult, even when authorities know people are doping, it's very difficult to get them to test positive on the tests because the cheaters seem to often be out ahead of the testers. So we'll see. We don't know, but it could mean that a number of high-profile athletes will not be competing, and it will definitely mean that more light will be shed, more sort of unwelcome light will be shed on a dark part of one of the banner sport of the Summer Olympics, which is track and field.
So has Nike responded at all to the scandal?
Yeah, Nike, I haven't seen any sort of public statement from them. I'm sure they will say something, and journalists and onlookers will be eager to see what it is they do say.
We'll definitely be keeping an eye out to see how this all unfolds, as especially it seems to actually mean a lot here in Oregon for an arrest that was made out in Spain.
It very well could.
Well, thanks for giving us the update, Emery.
You're welcome. Thanks, Jenna.
On Sunday, over 50,000 people in Okinawa, Japan protested against U.S. military bases on the island. A local woman was found raped and murdered last month, and an American contractor and former Marine was arrested for abandoning the body. The protesters want a review of the U.S.-Japanese security agreement, which allows 50,000 U.S. servicemen to be stationed in Okinawa. In 1995, a 12-year-old girl was kidnapped and raped by three American servicemen. This event sparked a national outcry, protests, and calls to move the military base to a less populated part of the island, which did not happen. The governor of Okinawa addressed the protesters in Okinawa's capital. He said, quote, "We had pledged never to repeat such an incident. I couldn't change the political system to prevent that. That is my utmost regret as a politician and as a governor of Okinawa," end quote. Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, supports the security agreement with the U.S., especially since China's military buildup in the East China Sea increases. Japan and China have both claimed ownership over five uninhabited islands located between Japan, China, and Taiwan, and tensions have been rising steadily in recent years. China has been increasing its military presence in the area, and on June 9th, a Chinese warship sailed within 24 miles of the disputed islands, sparking protests across Japan. A Russian warship also sailed near the islands on June 9th, and Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yoshihide Suga, said the government was investigating any possible link between the movements of Chinese and Russian vessels. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Abigail Sloan, Zach Martin, and Emery Mort. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Labor Radio. Our engineer is Liam Delta. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Roland hosts The End of Polar Ice and the World as We Know It, with guest professor Peter Wadhams, a foremost expert on Arctic sea ice. At 9 on Waterworld, Kristen Yount hosts an update on the EPA Superfund site at the Willamette Harbor with Rose Longoria of the Yakama Nation's Fisheries and Dr. Peter Defer, who created the consulting group Environmental Stewardship Concepts. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Recovery Zone, Stephanie Potter interviews Jennifer Jones and Jessica Applegate of the Eastside Air Coalition, Alma Velasquez of the Cully Air Action Team, and Sarah Clark of the South Portland Air Quality about the toxics in Portland's air. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Kanan.
Good night, Jenna. And good night, Liam. We'll be right back.
So the federal government leases public lands for coal mining, and the Bureau of Land Management, you know, most Americans don't know that this, the Bureau allows coal companies to mine coal on federal public lands. And that, of course, is terrible for the pollution that comes from the life cycle of coal and also for climate change. And it's particularly meaningful for us here in the West because the majority of coal that is mined from federal lands is mined in the Western region. This program is outdated. The cost of the coal mining and production and the price that is obtained for those coal leases is way outdated, which means that taxpayers in the U.S. have been losing billions of dollars in revenue. Meanwhile, it's destroying our public lands and worsening climate change, which, of course, here in the West, we're already suffering from in extreme ways through drought and forest fires and snowpack, and already adversely affecting our existing industries here in the West, things we care about a great deal, like outdoor recreation, clean energy, agriculture, fishing. All of these things are tied into how we have been seeing the federal government rolling out this program in a way that is not up to date and not equitable for what we're trying to do and the society we're trying to build in the West. And so in January, we had this amazing thing happen in which President Obama and Secretary Jewell announced a formal plan to reform how the federal coal leasing program is conducted. And so that included an immediate stop to approving new and modified coal leasing, with a few exceptions. But this put a pause on all of the, approving any new leases for coal from federal lands, which was just an incredible step taken forward. And so a big first step after that now is for the federal government to hear from Americans and American residents what the administration should consider in its analysis of the coal leasing program. And so this process is called a Programmatic Environmental Impact Statement, or a PEIS. And that process, you know, to collect this public input is happening all around the country. And we have one happening in Seattle today in our region